You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek, The Next Generation. Tonight's episode, When the Bow Breaks. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
This is the 17th episode of Season 1 of Star Trek The Next Generation. It was first aired on February 15th, 1988. It was written by Hannah Louise Scherer, directed by Kim Manners, and the guest stars for tonight, and there's quite a few stars, Jerry Harden as Radu, Brenda Strong as Rochella, Jandy Swanson as Katie, Paul Lambert as Milan? M-E-L-A-I-N? What do you think? Milane? I hope. Ivy, I hate names. Ivy Bethue as Duana. Dirk Torshk as Dr. Bernard. Michelle Marsh as Lida. Lida. But not Lita, Lida. Dan Mason as a colon. You're calling me a colon? Nice. Okay. Philip Walter as Harry. Connie Denise as Toya. Jessica and Vanessa Bova as Alexandra. Alexandra was played by twins?
I did not know that.
I did not know that either. I'm going to pull that up right now and take a look at the different pictures of the girls. It's the same picture. Come on, Memory Alpha. You could do better than that. It's the same picture. I guess we'll have to go a little deep. I'll have to investigate that a little deeper as we go on. So anyway, so what do we think about this episode? I am very much into the morality play. And as a father, and James can back me up on this, if my child suddenly vanished, there's going to be hell to pay. And there's no way that I'm going to just warp off because these people went behind their cloaking shield. I will spend the rest of my life getting into that cloaking shield. So what about you, James?
Alexandra is the actress that played Alexandra is 30. I mean, blimey, things to make you feel old, eh? No, I happen to agree. Actually, very similar to, I think, last week. I think this episode has a lot of good high-concept ideas behind it. It's actually got, you know, I think three or four of them, and they kind of all mesh together. I think it meshes better than last week, but I still think it's not particularly great.
You and I might be thinking different thoughts here later. But we'll talk about our final ratings later.
Okay, but before we do, I think we should head over to the forum to hear some listener feedback.
Oh, okay. What's it going to be today?
And today we are getting our feedback on Data Lore, which we had Bridget and Sean from the Rusted Robot podcast guest star. And you know, once again, thanks to those guys. Okay, sure. So the first post is from Captain Proton. He said, finally the great distinction between good data and evil data is revealed. Mm. Well, even if contractions are a metaphor for a mustache, it's better than a goatee. After all, a sweet stash is not something to be scoffed at. If I had a stash, I would twirl it around like a flag girl. I am glad Wesley tells the adults what's for. It shows he has some cojones at last. Speaking of cojones, how long into the episode where Riker fries some eggs? And I don't remember Riker frying up some eggs, but you apparently inform him that it is from Times Square, which is season 2.
Yep, that's when we find out that he really cannot fry up any eggs. Yep, Times Squared. And I said, what's funny about that episode is it always bothered me on the Riker versus Riker episode, which is right after Times Squared, called the Icarus Factor. Turns out Pulaski used to have a relationship with Kyle Riker. So, you know, in this one, you know, you mentioned Times Squared. Riker talks about how he got his cooking skills from his father, whom we meet in the very next episode. Now, you would think that that might jog Pulaski's memory of Kyle and mention, oh, by the way, did you know I used to bang your dad? I mean,
it's not something to bring up at the dinner table, though.
No, but, you know, I do want to tell you something later about your dad, because, you know, we were good friends at one time. We were pretty close. And I, you know, he was a great cook or something like that, but completely wrapped around the episode. So, obviously, you know, the scripts don't come out as quick. So, anyway, Datalore, I asked what was his rating on 1 to 5, and what does he give it?
Gives it a 5. But he already told you that he would.
Yeah, I know. But what then you responded back to...
Actually, I was very tempted to give it a 5 as well.
Were you?
Well, I just... I'm such an apologist. I really should not be allowed anywhere near a review podcast.
Oh no!
It's just that I watched the episode. I enjoyed the episode. I enjoy the bad episodes, and I think also in a certain way, sometimes I think that there are some episodes out there that are kind of important to the overall arc of Next Gen. So you kind of have to be introduced to Lore. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense when he comes back in Brothers. And I think Brothers is a great episode. You kind of have to be introduced to the Borg in Q-Who. Otherwise, the threat in The Best of Both Worlds isn't as prevalent. You kind of have to pick up Sins of the Father to see the repercussions later. So I've always considered Datalore as being an episode you need to have seen. And it just has a special place in my heart.
Okay. All right, then. But you heard that here.
Do not let me on any episode review show, because I'm clearly not the right guy to review these things.
Yeah. He says that as we continue on with our episode review show. Okay. Well, Kieran McDuff comes on with Evil Data. He's evil. But he's no evil Kirk evil. No. No yeomans were attempted to be raped in the making of this episode, after all. Good call. Good call on the fully functional issue. Lore was quite obviously more Ken doll than blow up doll when they were putting him together. Hey, maybe there was a screw in the attachment part that we never saw on camera. I actually quite like the concept of Lore, another Sung android without the same morals as Data. But this was a bit of a cheesy episode to introduce him. Pretending to be Data was a pretty obvious thing to do, and it was pretty stupid of the crew not to even consider the prospect for long. Sadly, although I quite like his appearance in Brothers, as you mentioned, they never really used Lore to his full potential. King of the Borg was pretty silly, too. The crystalline entity was also an interesting concept of space... born life form. I always like it when they introduce life, Jim, but not as we know it. Not as we know it. Not as we know it, Captain. Oh, I continued that. He always likes it when we introduce life, Jim, but not as we know it. But again, they could have done a lot more with it. At least when it turns up in a later episode, they expand on it a lot. Why it turned up so quickly in this one was just random, and... why it should talk to Lore, I could never understand, and it never seemed to be explained. And we mentioned that, didn't we? How could it possibly talk to Lore? It says, I'm afraid I'm giving this episode another 2 out of 5. It's pretty poor on its own, even if it did introduce some interesting aspects. And, he goes on to say, P.S., the hottest woman in Star Trek was Jadzia Dax in Trials and Tribulations. Amen. Prior to that, it was Yeoman Barrows in Shore Leave. I tend to agree with him. As far as the hottest woman in Star Trek, yeah, Jadzia Dax. I want to count spots myself. And Yeoman Baros, when that tunic got ripped, I had to say she was dang tot. But I'll never back off on the cutest thing in Star Trek is Naomi Wildman, hands down. Go on.
Great. and then all I mean, I just put a, you know, another thanks out to the Rusted Robot crew for coming on. And I do enjoy their podcast, and I sent in feedback and other bits and pieces to their show. They're just getting started. And the thing I like about them so much is that they're so positive. They're so positive about everything they do. They think everything is great and awesome, and they've, I think maybe it's living in England under the horrendous rain and the, you know, the bad weather that makes our outlook slightly more negative. But then they're in Canada, so they surely must be used to the same type of things.
Yeah, I guess so. Okay. I was surprised to find that they still had ice and snow, though. But, okay. Understood. All right. Yeah, they really are an interesting couple. I mean, they really like working together, and it shows when they talk. So, thanks again, guys, for coming on. All right. And so that takes us to the end of our feedback for Data Lore. So let's go ahead and quickly go through When the Bow Breaks.
Oh. So I have to say, I think I get the impression you're going to like this episode more than I do. But this episode opens up with Riker wandering around and a child running into him. And there's an exchange between them. And at this point, I think, oh, it's going to be a children episode.
Yep. Kids on a starship.
Yes.
It should be fun.
But in fairness to them, they follow up the, you know, the bad very, very first scene with my favorite line of Star Trek so far.
Uh-oh. Well, let me see, and if I can figure that one out.
Can you guess what it is? You
the must calculus.
He said, everyone needs an understanding of basic calculus, whether they like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's true.
Okay. All right. Calculus at such a young age, though. I mean, Harry looks about 8 to 10 years old. Calculus? That early?
Yeah. I mean, you shouldn't. You don't need to be doing that into you. You do calculus when you're 16. Right. Top. It's at that level that you should be doing it. You know, I think that, I don't know whether or not, are they throwing this around to make it sound futuristic and how much clever they are, or do people in the U.S. really learn calculus at 8?
Oh, but remember, it's not a U.S. thing. I mean, it's not a, we're all one united, I want to say kingdom, but we're all one united being in the 24th century. So, yeah, I think all children everywhere are just smarter because we're more enlightened. I think that's probably the joke there. You know, calculus. I don't want to take calculus. I hate calculus. I don't get it. I'm not smart. You know, you can do it. Everybody needs a basic understanding of calculus. And, you know, he gives Riker a glance as he grabs him by the arm and whisks him away.
I mean, in fairness, even if it's written slightly as a joke, I think anyone that's on a starship probably does need a basic understanding of calculus.
If they're running the starship.
Yeah.
You know, but this kid, I mean, and that raises a point. Now that we've got our first kid episode on TNG, at some point you and I are going to have to come up with, what do the children do? I mean, they go to school, but after
school.
You see
them at school.
Right. After school, then what? What is there to do on the Enterprise that would be so much fun for a kid to spend his entire existence there?
What, doesn't Wesley mention in Encounter at Farpoint that it would be hard to get bored on a starship like this?
Well, perhaps. I mean, it'd be hard to get bored on the holodeck, but I assume children aren't usually permitted to use a holodeck without parental supervision. So unless there's like arcades all over the place, unless there is a holodeck that's specifically designed for kids to have an outdoor environment that runs 24 hours a day, what exactly is a child of Harry's age to do when he's out of school? Go back to his quarters and sit there? Nobody has a TV. I mean, what is there to do?
I like the idea of there being a deck entirely dedicated to, you know, like a soft play area. So like deck 21, it's the children's play area, and that's all it is. And you drop your kids off after school and you pick them up like 4 hours later after they've been involved in some type of a, you know, brutal physical punishment of, you know, climbing ropes and all the rest of it.
That is interesting. There's got to be something more for kids than just to be in space. You can't go out and play outside, so, yeah. Okay, well, anyway, so Harry runs into Riker and causes him to limp. Really? 35-pound child running into your leg, do you think that would hurt that much? I guess full steam, bam, he hit him.
And Riker's not a small guy, right? He's a big guy. He's a tall, well-built bloke. So it's surprising that he would have a limp.
Right. But here's an Easter egg, and here's something that I never noticed ever until I watched it just this time. Did anyone notice the tripod leg inside the turbo lift when Riker entered it?
No.
He exits one turbo lift, is walking down the corridor as Picard tells him he needs to report to the bridge. And instead of just turning around and going back to the turbo lift, he walks down the hall so that Harry can bump into him. And then he walks into another turbo lift and you see the tripod leg.
I will have to watch it. I will have to watch that again and I'll have to keep my eyes open because I did not see that.
All right. Like, did you see the hand come in and take Mistress Beata's glass? I don't know if you checked that one yet.
I didn't. You're watching all of this much more observantly than I am.
Well,
you're making me feel bad.
I never did before, but when we do this, I got this notion of how to do this from the Gamma Quadrant. I mean, they really pulled out a lot of things. So now when I'm watching, I really am observing and trying to write down things that I happen to see that I've never seen before. So, but I mean, when we get to some of those big, big episodes, I'd be able to do the dialogue with them. I've listened to them so many times in the car while delivering pizzas, I could do the dialogue. So, anyway. So we have faint energy readings that lead us to a point in space, but then it stops. So where are we, Geordi? He says we're in the Epsilon Minos system. Now, when he said Epsilon Minos, did that trigger any faint memory to you?
I'm going to say no, I'm afraid.
Minos. That was the name of the planet in the Lorenz cluster where they made the automated weapon systems and its pushy hologram salesperson to sell the weapons to anyone who wants them. So beam on down.
We haven't got to that one yet.
No, we haven't. But I mean, I'm just saying that I remember when he said the Epsilon Minos system, that we go back to Minos, another Minos later. It's one of those, what was the episode that we were talking about, the outdoor scene? Every time it showed up, we kept thinking, well, that particular outdoor scene is seen forever.
Well, Angel One has that. Has that painting in it.
Yeah, so, I mean, some words and things they just use all over.
Yeah, agreed.
But Riker gets all excited about this system. Tell him why.
Oh, because it is where people believe a mystical planet to be, a mystical hidden planet called Aldea. And, I mean, as I mentioned last week, I get very confused between these planets. So between Aldea and Haven and Angel One, I can never remember which one is which. But it's a mystical planet that the inhabitants are, I suppose, shrouded in mystery and legend. And for some reason, no one's been able to find it. but it seems quite obvious where it is. And even Troy starts, you know, picking up that there are other people out there. So it surprises me that that no one in the past could have found it.
Centuries old, self-contained, where no one could be a member unless they want you. Unless you have something they want. And they're able to cloak the entire planet so that no one can plunder their grass or even fossil fuel.
True, true. Can I raise a scientific inaccuracy of the week?
Is it about the ozone?
It's actually, the ozone is coming later.
Okay.
But you can't cloak a planet. And even if you did cloak a planet, of course you can cloak a planet. That's fine. What I should say instead is that if you were to cloak a planet, there are some side effects you should probably be aware of. And then the other one is that if you could cloak a planet, it doesn't really matter. You could still be found. So the first one, they describe the cloaking device as, it's a way of diverting away the electromagnetic spectrum so that you don't appear as light. So anything that is sitting in space, light hits it, it reflects off it, and it goes into your eye, and you can see a planet there. And what this is supposed to do, it's supposed to bend light around it in a way that you can't see that it's there. What this means, though, is that the planet will be in darkness for all time. So if you have a cloaking device, if you're inside the cloaking device, you're not receiving any light from the sun. So you can't be, you're going to be, everything on the planet is going to die, it's going to be horrendously cold, and it's not going to be a very good place to live. Because, you know, otherwise you'll be able to detect the fact that the light has been absorbed by the planet. So, you know, that's the first thing. You should probably not be too keen to go to a planet that's cloaked, because you're not going to be particularly comfortable. And then the second thing is that even if you do buy the fact that they've cloaked the planet and they're living on the planet somehow, you don't need to detect light in order to know that the planet is there. So in particular, even nowadays, if you want to know if a planet or a body is out there in space, you look at the effect that the body has on surrounding objects through gravity. So if this thing had a moon, or if it had this thing went around a sun, you will be able to know where the planet is based on the sun wobbling and being pulled off its center by the planet as it goes around the sun. And whenever astronomers look into space and they identify that there are planets around suns out there, I'm not 100% up to date, but I don't believe that we've ever seen a planet in terms of a visible spectrum. What we always pick up when we detect planets, we detect the wobble of the sun due to the planet going around the sun. And the theory, you know, you don't need to see the planet to know that the planet's there. Anyway, that's my that's my scientific inaccuracy of the week.
Okay, and in my best Rick Moranis on Spaceballs, everybody got that? Good. Let's continue. Okay, that is interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, well, anyway, scanners show nothing, sir, but Troy's sensing thousands of mine. Only thousands? Only thousands? How can she tell if it's thousands of minds, 10 minds, 5 minds, 100 minds? Only thousands?
Well, you would imagine, right, at a certain point, I mean, you can probably tell one mind versus two versus three, but at a certain point it becomes kind of many, right? So you probably can't very easily, if you could hear everyone's thoughts, it would probably be very difficult for you to distinguish between 200,000 and 700,000, because you wouldn't be able to count them and you wouldn't be able to be aware of that many people. So it's strange that it's strange that she can be so accurate when mentioning how many people she can hear.
You're right, and I remember hearing on podcasts people would complain that how can Deanna Troi possibly sense deception on the view screen? Well, this one even does better. She's sensing these minds through the ship's hull and out into space. How exactly does mind telepathy work in the vacuum of space?
I, by the way, I think you could end that sentence before you get to the vacuum of space.
Yeah.
How does mind telepathy work?
Yeah.
Full stop.
Full stop. Okay. It just makes no sense, you know. Anyway.
Well, I mean, but certainly, by the fact, yeah, throw the vacuum of space in, it makes it harder. And then throw the fact that these are different, you know, these aren't humans, these are aliens, and she's another alien, and there's no guarantee that, you know, people think in the same kind of logical structure as we do. And actually, I don't know if you've noticed, by the way, but over the last, you know, 5 or 6 weeks, I think, they've got relatively sloppy with a lot of their aliens. So a lot of the aliens look exactly human.
Right.
So these guys look exactly human. There's nothing that distinguishing them. The Justice guys were exactly human. The guys on Angel One were exactly human. We see a lot of this in the first season. So many planets are exactly human. The guys on Haven are exactly human. It's very... It becomes very... Perhaps this is one of the reasons why I have sometimes difficulty remembering which episode is which, because the aliens are always exactly human.
Right. And then we have Jerry Hardin back later as Mark Twain.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just then, as she starts to sense that there's thousands of minds, the planet decloaks, which causes Riker to suffer his first orgasm on the bridge. The planet hails the ship and wants to have dinner. Why? Because Mark Twain or Sam Clemens beams aboard to discuss that. They bring flowers or whatever that is to convince him to come down to the planet to discuss business. No biggie. Let's just talk and get used to each other. But, you know, our eyes, they're sensitive to bright lights. We've got to go. Does that sound familiar? Sensitive to bright lights and what was the other thing? No, they were just sensitive to bright lights. Because then when other series, like Voyager, we have species that it's too cold in here, you know.
Yeah, and the Kardashians find things too cold, right?
Oh, yeah.
That they think things are too cold. I mean, it would be extremely unusual for every species that you encounter to be comfortable with the temperature, the amount of oxygen, the light, the gravity, all of those things. I mean, every now and again, you have a little bit of a nod in one or two of those directions, but you never come across a species that requires, you know, 50 times the gravity, a vast amount of light, but to be absolutely freezing.
Yeah, that is odd.
At the same time, it's going to be very difficult to tell a story, right?
if
you actually physically can't meet with anyone, because, you know, actually one's a jellyfish, one's a rock, and the other one looks a bit like a teapot, and that's about all the interaction you're going to have with other alien races.
Right. Well, on Voyager, the people that were replacing the crew, they needed it a lot warmer and a lot darker, but yet, you know, they cranked up the heat for them, but no one on Voyager perspired, so humans obviously don't sweat in the future. So anyway, but Troy figures out that they want something from us, something we value greatly, something they know we won't part with.
At which point, the episode ends, right? Because they say, well, this is too dangerous to hang around here. We better be on our way.
Really? Yeah, there's something wrong here, Captain. I sense considerable deception. Well, then, let's turn around and let's leave. We found him. Let's go. But nope. Swish! Transporter beam of some kind takes Riker, Troy, and Crusher, which Picard thinks are interesting choices. I don't know why at this point.
We're all so interested about that, right? Yeah. What's the interesting bit? You know, it's almost as if he's thinking about following up by, personally, I would have taken Geordi, Data, and Worf. I don't know what they're trying to get to.
Yeah. Well, he was probably jealous. Why weren't they interested in me? So anyway, Data's given Wesley a lesson on how to cloak a planet, much kind of like what you did for us. And an energy beam scans everyone on the bridge, but it stops when it gets to Wesley.
And I don't know if you noticed, but Picard and Data tries to reach out to Wesley to help him, and Picard shouts, "Don't touch him!" And I don't know why Picard knew more than Data, or if Picard was actually thinking, you know, good, they finally got Wesley.
Yeah.
Don't touch him! Leave it! Let him go! You know, don't start a fight here. That seemed weird.
Right. So anyway, okay, well, they need help. They need a younger generation to carry on the legacy, so how can we help? They want our kiddies. Yes. You know, I was just thinking that maybe I can send them my child. I don't know. It's a small token, but let's see if it works. Maybe and, not.
And did you notice that... Okay. I'll have two scientific inaccuracies of the week here.
Oh, boy.
You can't repopulate a population with six kids. It's not a wide enough gene pool.
Well, you obviously never heard of Adam and Eve.
with six kids, you're basically going to get three generations before they'll die. It's not enough. And I don't know. It doesn't seem in any way reasonable. And they you know, it's not even a case here that they're trying to get like only the next generation, and that's it. They specifically mention the fact that these are going to be the guys that are going to continue the legacy, and you know, these are going to be the people that have the children that are going to repopulate or bring more to society. Right. And you're just not going to get it out of seven kids or however many there were.
But, you know, like I say, we're willing to give you Wesley, though. You can have one kid. That's it. Troy says that might work with some other races, but humans are unusually attached to their offspring. I have a couple points of problem with that. Number one, what does she mean unusually attached? Would a Romulan give up their children? A Cardassian, a Vulcan? So what's so unusual?
I mean, it is established later that, I mean, Kardashians in particular have a huge connection to the family. That they certainly wouldn't, you know, give up their kids.
Mm-mm. So, I mean, what is so unusual about it?
Well, I think what really this is doing, this is just a way of, this is a way of Troy being able to, like, you know, nod to the audience and say, you know, we appreciate that humanity is special because we love our kids. I think they're not doing much more than that here.
Okay. But anyway, they start disappearing. But it seems like not all of them. Now, I noticed, like, when they had a shot in a classroom, some kids were disappearing, but others were staying. Or do you think maybe they got all the kids? Because obviously, when you think about it, the group that beams back with Wesley, this flash forward, there was only, what, six kids?
Yeah, I think it's six.
So is that all they needed was the six kids?
I think
that's
they,
all.
They would clearly need more. I mean, the thing that they, it's kind of put across in the episode, what they're looking for is some type of, you know, inner spirit to let free and, you know, do great stuff. In reality, what these guys do need, they need a gene pool, and they should have taken as many kids as they possibly can, and, you know, try to get as much breeding going on as they can. But they do mention that, I think when the parents all get together in the ready in the observation room, they do mention that, you know, why our kids? And so they definitely leave some kids behind. That's
right.
Certainly true.
But, you know, I just had a thought right this second here as you were talking. Why not? I mean, there's a lot of people who are interested in Aldea, like Riker was. So why don't they look for in the society, in a lot of societies, people, not necessarily children, but people who are willing to come to the planet, live there, and repopulate their species. And besides, here's a problem. You bring all these children, all of them looked human. Now we have a new race of Aldeans, and the point is now you've got no Aldeans in the future. It's all human. So mm-hmm. What's the point of bringing a bunch of human children to repopulate your world. Unless, of course, they're going to wait for them to grow up, so then the Aldeans could start breeding with them.
I mean, they don't give the impression that that's going to happen, although in complete fairness, if that was their plan, they probably wouldn't announce it, right?
No.
Is that we're going to bring your young kids, and you know, when they're old enough, we're going to make sure that at least a part of the Aldean gene pool survives. You don't want to be saying that to your parents. But they give the impression of they're just looking for people to carry on, you know, almost as if they're looking for immigrants to come in, invite immigrants into their planet so that they can carry on, because they don't have a sustainable, you know, either workforce or, you know, group of people to do whatever they need to do in life. So it should be pretty easy to find people. You just announce that you're looking for people of exceptional talent, and if you would like to come to a planet where you can spend your entire life, you know, being trained and honing your skills in the arts, there must be plenty of people that want to jump that bandwagon.
That makes sense. Okay.
And there are probably some young kids as well. I mean, not necessarily 2-year-olds, but you'll probably find some people that are, you know, into their late teens that will think it's a great way to start a new life.
Sure.
To me, it doesn't sound like they need to use any subterfuge to start kidnapping the kids.
Okay, so now they want to talk about compensation. What do you think a good compensation would be? I mean, what were they going to give them? Information about the galaxy?
To me, it doesn't. I mean, would these guys have any information about the galaxy? They seem to be quite insular,
right?
They obviously have technology, right? And they demonstrate the technology a little bit later on. But information about the galaxy, it seems unlikely that they would have anything. Mm-hmm. But I think Picard kind of probably sums it up correctly, and to a certain extent, this has to be there in order for the episode not to end as soon as the guys get the children, which is that, you know, I think they're offering compensation as a way of making them feel better, making them, you know, acknowledging that they've taken something and they have obviously a moral code that means they have to give something back. And I mean, I think from the human's perspective, there's nothing they could give, but it does provide the crew with a little bit of leverage and a little bit of, you know, buying time. Because otherwise they would have just disappeared and, you know, the episode's finished and Wesley exits halfway through season one rather than waiting all the way for season four.
Uh-huh. That would have been the benefit. Okay. Well, and there was one sad part about this. I mean, beyond the kids, but it was, I'd have to say, Dr. Bernard. You know, he's relating to the group that last time he saw Harry, he yelled at him. And actually, you know, I kind of got sad because of something that happened to us in real life. My daughter's friends in school, she was friends with the girl that she's in the same class with and her little sister who's one grade behind her. And they used to come over for sleepovers, and my daughter used to go over there for sleepovers. And the last time the little girl was over, the one who was a little younger, she stole a few things from Alexa. Like Nintendo DSi games or something. You know, we figured out what it was that was taken, and we called her father, and he actually found him in her room. So, you know, he was very upset with her. That was on a Saturday. He yelled at her and told her she was grounded from something. And then he went on Monday for a medical procedure where he had to have surgery, and he died on the table. And so I felt terrible because of the fact that, you know, I would have let her have them rather than her get in trouble with him and him be mad at her the day he died. And you know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. That's a terrible story. It is.
That's why I got real sad, you know, when I hear like Dr. Bernard talk about the last time he saw Harry. Yeah, that just reminds me of that, and I hate it. I feel horrible for this little girl, and she goes through the rest of her life, and the last thing she remembers is her daddy was mad at her and grounded her. And, it's horrible. So anyway, back on the planet, Alexandra's playing a game of hide-and-seek. Did you notice that when she's found, she gives her captor a kiss?
Yes, yeah. I mean, it made me even wonder whether these two are related, because they seem to have a lot of affection on screen. I think sometimes you can, if you bring in, like, you know, a mum and a daughter, or, a mum and other relatives, you can kind of get a bit of chemistry on set without people needing to act. And there was a lot of affection shown, and I don't think it's the case, but it did make me wonder whether or not they were actually related.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, I didn't mention this at the top of the show, and I wish I had, because I try to do like a little Easter egg thing. I'm trying to figure things that we've never seen before, or kind of build up the suspense to the point, because I'm about to blow it here. The custodian. Oh, that creeps me out. The custodian absolutely creeps me out. So Wesley visits the custodian to get his level 3 clearance, which means he can ask him a question. Instead of asking the custodian, he asks his new mommy, what's its power source? And does it matter? Well, yeah. Every computer, custodian, needs to be repaired from time to time. But anyway, that's not what bothers me. What bothers me is when he says, custodian, let me see Harry. Wait a minute. How does custodian have access to any camera view of Harry? Where can it go? In the bathroom? In the bedroom? You know, custodian, let me see Alexandra. Wow, there's some serious privacy issues on this when custodian can monitor your children.
It looks pretty much like a 24/7 all-seeing eye here, doesn't it? The custodian seems to be able to look in on anyone at any point. I mean, perhaps that's the reason why they don't have any children.
Maybe. I mean, it's got so much perv potential. If somebody with level 3 clearance can look into the bedrooms of all the children, I have a problem with that. And as a parent, wow. And I don't – do these people in their society even know? I mean, whatever her name was, it was going to be Wesley's new mother. She obviously knows. She's looking at him, ask, let me see Harry. I mean, do they accept that they're under camera 24/7?
I don't know. By the way, was that was the woman that was in there, was that supposed to be Wesley's new adopted family? Because I think we saw a lot of the younger kids go, and they were picked up by usually a man and a wife or whatever, and they sat down and they did some bits and pieces. Right. But Wesley seemed to be slightly at odd. He didn't seem to be introduced to like a craft or a skill he was expected to practice. He seemed to be there just as a leader. And I didn't, maybe I'm just being dozy, but I didn't quite get the fact that he was supposed to live with that woman.
That's true. It doesn't really say that. I just kind of assume, since everybody else was given someone, except for Alexandra, I can't think of her name, just decided she wanted to keep her.
Yes, that's right. I don't like the fact that woman prevented Alexandra being placed with the adoptive parent family that she was supposed to end up with. I don't think it added a huge amount to the story, other than just to show that there's kind of a maternal weakness there, that just the small kid that was very cute seemed to rub the woman up the right way, and she wanted to keep her all for herself.
Right. What about the people who were supposed to get Alexandra? Now they didn't get nobody. Yeah. But anyway, the whole thing creeps me out that custodian could look in on people, even adults. It's just obviously kids is special, and you should not have something that could just look in on a kid's bedroom anytime it wants. That's really seriously wrong. And another thing is, did Harry get level 3 clearance on custodian?
I don't know, but I assume, by the way, when they say level 3, I assume that's not a particularly high level of clearance.
No.
I assume they're not going to be given, they're not going to be given Wesley complete access to everything. So I would imagine that's a kind of like a standard clearance for inquiries and the like.
Right, but who, in near the end, when all the kids showed up, I don't know, in the meeting room or wherever, they come in through the custodian, who's the one that sent them? I would have thought maybe it was Wesley somehow.
Yeah, maybe. I thought... No, I think so. I think it was.
Okay. All right. And I think Wesley's new mom was Duana. I'm not sure about that. I'm looking at the guest star list. So Alexandra went to Rochella. And
yes.
I think it was Duana. So anyway, Beverly visits Wesley at his new home and gives him the scanning piece for the tricorder that scans Duana, I believe. And now, I thought the scanner, whenever the scanner was used, it made a noise, didn't it?
Well, it, yes, I think it does make a noise, or at least there's usually a noise to indicate that it's working, you know, because otherwise I suppose the audience might be too stupid to notice. Something that, I mean, I thought that this particular part was relatively embarrassing, in the sense that they bring obviously Beverly in to speak to Wesley. She hands over the scanning device. There's a cut that makes it extremely clear that she's handing something over. He kind of opens the palm of his hand, almost looks at it for a second, puts it in, and then wanders over in an extremely obvious manner to the, you know, to the lady that's standing there, and kind of scans her while she could clearly see what he was up to. He walks back to Dr. Crusher and hands it back to him. Hands it back to her. I think that she must have been pretty dozy not to notice what was going on.
Oh, absolutely. Either that, or maybe she just thought, "Oh, these silly people. What are they trying to get away with?" But yeah, right. I think maybe they could have done without the close up and him. Like, what's this? You know? Oh. Okay.
And I seem to remember in other episodes, and maybe I'm wrong, but I thought that a tricorder you didn't need to poke someone in the face with the auxiliary scanning majig. You could just leave a tricorder open and it would kind of passively scan.
Right.
But I don't quite...
Yeah, because it looks like she actually sticks her fingers in her pocket to make it actually start scanning. So I guess you could say that's their Bluetooth.
I suppose so. Although, you know, I suppose for the day, right? It's a demonstration of fundamentally Bluetooth technology.
Right. Okay. All right. So the All Danes hang up on the away team again by beaming Picard and Crusher back to the ship as a show of strength. What do? They knock them 3 days away from the planet and warn them that if they don't take their offer, they'll send the ship so far their children will be grandchildren before the Enterprise shows up again. And I thought, how could that be?
Is that what you thought? Because I thought, isn't that what happened to Voyager?
Yeah. So they're planning to send it to a different quadrant?
Well, it must be. It must be. Because as far as I remember, wasn't Voyager 70 years away? In terms of, in terms of the time that it would take. So give or take, it's of that order of magnitude.
But then again, I guess Alexandra's how old? 8?
I think maybe a little younger, but
okay,
let's say
5. All right, so an old Dan waits 13 years before he marries her. She's now 18, that's 13. And he marries her, they have a children who, you know, has to be 18. So 18 plus 13, what's that, 31?
Mm-hmm.
So now we're at 31 years old by the time she has a child who turns 18. So now we're at 49. So I would say, you know, they could be about 50 or so before they become grandparents. So that's not really all that long away, I suppose. But still, it almost have to be a different quadrant away.
Yeah, I would have thought so. I think you're talking significantly far away. Not kind of crazy where no one has gone before far away, but certainly within the galaxy, kicked out of Federation space.
Okay.
Although I often find that I think that there is a bit of it's a relatively nebulous term when they have the Federation space. Sometimes you'll be in Federation space, but be so far from Earth that you won't be able to communicate live over subspace. You know, they'll send the message and it'll take 2 days to get there and 2 days to get back. And in other cases, you can be on the Federation border and can like warp back to fight the Borg as they're coming into, you know, coming into Earth. So, I'm pretty sure that there have been instances where Federation space is kind of like as big as the plot needs it to be.
Right, right. I remember Brian used to tell me a lot of times, this is Dedimore, I mean, used to tell me that Romulus is actually in the Beta Quadrant.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I think that there's a number of instances which refer to either in the Beta or the Alpha Quadrant, depending on who you listen to. But there are certainly instances of being in the Beta Quadrant.
Really? Because it's like, how do we get to the Beta Quadrant so fast?
What I think is because I think Earth is supposed to be on the border between the Alpha and the Beta. Because I think it's in Star Trek VI, right? Mm-hmm. Where Sulu's in the Beta Quadrant and he's rushing back. And, you know, he mentions that he's still in the Beta Quadrant and he's rushing back to get into the Alpha Quadrant, just on the edge at least, in order to save the day.
But I always wondered if that was a case of they didn't quite understand how big each quadrant would have been at the time.
Well, I think it's certainly true, by the way, that in the original series, certainly, you hear the term quadrant and they don't mean, you know, a quarter of the galaxy, because later on when you get into the Voyager Deep Space Nine latter TNG, quadrant is certainly, you know, a quarter of the galaxy, you know, cut basically a pizza cut in four, and you know, Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta, and that's it. Whereas in the original series you'll hear much more of kind of like quadrants, as you know quadrant, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it will almost be a much smaller chunk. And it's clear that they're obviously referring to that because they have very long names, like, you know, Quadrant 29784 or something. I don't think that was ever one of them. But you get the impression that there was a difference between the old original series and the latter years.
Yeah. Okay. And besides, that's my slice of pizza that I prefer, is a quarter of a whole one. So, okay. Alexandra is given his musical instrument that can read her mind through her hand and play the notes that she's thinking, but she can't come up with anything happy. It's just a little sad. That's an interesting musical piece. Wouldn't that be nice to have?
You mean the instrument? Yeah. I mean, it's, well, I mean, without being all, without being, how should I put it? I mean, music isn't necessary, just about expressing what's inside in a nice way. There's also kind of like technique, and how you play it is also important. So what they had in terms of the instruments, and in fact, they had a lot of this throughout the episode, you know, even with the carving tools that were being provided. Right. It seemed to take a lot of the technical aspect out of the job. So it kind of stripped away the technical ability to shape the wood. It took away the technical ability to play the music, and you were just solely left with the artistic interpretation. And I mean, maybe that's what the writers of the show were going for, because they did specifically mention that these guys were artists in kind of the purest sense. But I did find it interesting that they even removed the technical challenges of creating art. Which I think is not, well, it's a deep question. I don't think it's necessarily desirable. I think, you know, the tools that you use in order to create the art are sometimes as important as what you actually produce at the end. And I think you can see instances throughout history where what has been produced has been astonishing, not just because of the sheer beauty of it, but it's also due to what kind of things they had available at the time. Because, frankly, anyone could probably build the pyramids these days with concrete, but what makes them special is when they were able to do it, at what stage, in you know, with the tools available. But anyway, sorry, I've got off on a tangent.
Well, that's okay. No, I was also thinking about Harry. You mentioned Harry's carving instrument, and I thought, you know, yes. Remember when they went on their hunger strike And Radu has to call the Enterprise and say, you need to talk to these children. They're on some kind of hunger strike. We're not real prepared to handle this. And I thought, well, gee, what if Harry was to use that carving tool against the person that was standing right above him to slice to the throat? And not, you know, next thing you know, Harry's on a killing spree. That conversation might have been a whole lot different. You know, Captain, you need to talk to this child. He's killing our people down here, and we ain't got very many to go through.
And actually, you know, being a parent of small children, I did find it humorous, at least, that, you know, after 3 days of having, you know, having the kids basically staying over with their grandparents, mm-hmm. you got in the mail saying, oh, they're misbehaving. We don't know what to do. We're at a loss here. Can you please talk to your children? I assume that by the time these guys hit her, you know, hit puberty and so on, the Aldeans are going to want them off the planet.
Right.
So maybe it's actually a good thing that in the end they didn't end up keeping them.
Yeah. And then there was a soft reference after Harry's done with his dolphin of. You know, I want to call it his mother now, has to apply some kind of cream to her hand because of the condition that they're suffering mm-hmm. from. So they don't really talk much about that.
No, they don't. But you do get, and I don't quite know what I feel about this. You do get references to kind of things having gone wrong. You get the there was mentioned about, you know, the dolphin being a fish, but obviously not a fish, but a different type of fish. And it swims in the oceans, and they mention, oh, we used to have fish in the ocean. And then she's obviously put it on some kind of cream to make sure that you know, whatever she has goes away. And it's then mentioned later on about the ozone, and they draw parallels with 20th century or 21st century Earth. And I think sometimes they, you know, it can be good because it obviously it allows the storytelling to be applicable to modern day life, but sometimes you can put it on a little bit too thick.
I was going to say, it's even in my notes, word for word, says, did you notice today's propaganda? Says, please listen to me, says Dr. Crusher. You're suffering from the same thing humans suffered from when their ozone was deteriorated in the 21st century. And this is one thing Star Trek does a lot of, the heavy-handed, that we must change our ways before something bad happens. And, you know, what it doesn't tell you is that humans were able to counter-effect. Okay, so they were able to counter-effect their pollution problems and their ozone problems. You know, so if we continue today, they don't tell you on Star Trek that you could just do what we did to, you know, solidify our ozone, because obviously we don't know if it's even happening for real or if there is a way to stop it. But yeah, you're right. Star Trek does that a lot. It loves to give you the message of the day is be better to our planet, because if you don't, this is what can happen.
And I don't think you have to, even if you wanted to put across that message, and even if you wanted to be as clear as possible, you don't necessarily have to reference, or in the late 20th century, somewhere around, I don't know, 1988, human activity was causing problems to the planet. You don't have to be so obvious and tie it in so strongly.
Right.
I mean, having said all of this, of course, according to Star Trek history, not quite in 1988, but very soon, and certainly when you're talking about the early 21st century, I think the ozone layer is one of the least of our worries, as we're plunged into the Third World War.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, let's get the messages aside. Wesley decides to start a nighttime resistance, and the first thing he does is visit Katie's bedroom. Hey,
yes.
Now, what'd you think? Now, watch it, guys. You know, don't forget, there are some games that he doesn't quite know about just yet, right? But anyway, he wants the kids to begin their hunger strike, and the adults just don't know what to do about it. And as we talked about it, they had to call for help. Let's see here. So, in the meantime, Geordi has detected a fluctuation in their shield and can pretty much beam someone down to the planet, shut down the system. Good job, Geordi! You know, I predict someday in the future, Geordi just might make chief engineer someday, because obviously no one else can do it.
I mean, he has a lot of good ideas.
Yes, he does.
And a lot of potential.
Yes, we're taking notes, Geordi. You may make chief engineer. Let's talk about the little controller on everybody's arm. Okay. Let's see here. It just seems like a very simple push button at the top of it. There's nothing on the side of it, no buttons to press or anything. Now, you've heard me. I think I've talked before. I'm not sure about on the Battle Bridge, but definitely on the Lou Trek show. You know, when Picard says three to beam up and the transporter chief doesn't say, all right, which three? You know, that's one thing. But this device is even better. All you have to do is push the button and it does what you want it to do, even if you didn't tell it to do anything. So, go ahead.
Indeed. Yeah. No, absolutely.
So when you want just Picard and Crusher to be sent back to the ship, but the children stay, press the button and somehow the right people flash away. Now, that is amazing.
It's obviously a very context-specific button.
Yes.
You just press to confirm.
Right.
I mean, there must be some way, I mean, to get out of this, as an apologist, you say that it's, you know, it's got a direct connection into your brain, it can understands what you're thinking, and you're basically just actioning it by pressing the button. But realistically, if it knew what you were thinking, then you don't need the button, right?
It just does it.
You kind of just, you do it by yourself. You know, you have the power, you know, you effectively have the power of the cue through technology, and you can make things happen. But yeah, it seems a very strange system of having to A, press a button, and B, the button knowing exactly what you need it to do.
Mm. Okay. Well, obviously, I was just thinking maybe, I think what it is that the custodian, he got a copy of the script way before this ever happened and knew exactly what was going to happen. So he's just another stagehand, you know, beaming people up when they need to or not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's now we're at the end of this. Even though we said we weren't going to talk a lot about it, we did anyway. Dan, I want to be an artist. I don't want to take calculus. And now Dr. Bernard has a much different approach to him. Harry, you could be anything you want to be, anything, but you still have to take calculus. That dog. Can you hear the dog barking?
Well, barely. It's okay. Okay. It's okay.
Okay, so what's Harry say? He says, okay, thanks, Dad. Well, he's not mad at Harry anymore, so, you know, he doesn't slap Harry in the face when he's entering their quarters. Oh, he does. No, he does give Harry a little slap in the face, but, you know, as he's entering their quarters.
Could I just go, let me go back one little bit, because Geordi manages to get Riker and Data down to the planet. Mm-hmm. That's great. And Riker and Data go into the custodian's room and they try to get, you know, they basically try to shut it down.
Right.
And Data has a look and he, you know, does whatever he needs to do. And he gets to the point where he ends up saying that he can't access it because it only recognizes specific voices or specific, you know, people. And I don't know, at that point, surely Data should just mimic the voice.
But whose voice would he mimic?
Is it Radu?
Yeah, I guess. He must have level 1000 clearance.
Yeah, we've interacted with some of the people from the planet. We should use their voice and just, you know, shut down whatever needs to be shut down.
Right.
I suppose, you know, he might not have the clearance, of course, but they don't, you know, at no point do they assume that, you know, that the Data could get around this, you know, could get around the fact that it needs voice identification from someone else. Mm. And realistically, Data should be able to do that, and obviously later does in other episodes when he, you know, takes command of the Enterprise and all the good stuff that follows.
Right, yeah. The access key that he puts in. I had that written down one time and I can't find it. 737 blue enable. Anyway, the point is here's another thing that they never thought of on Aldea. How about intruder alert? How does somebody even get into the custodian room without triggering an intruder alert?
Yeah, no, I think that's a valid point. Certainly for a species that are so secretive and, you know, cloak themselves, you would imagine they would be paranoid about intruders.
Right. Okay. Well, anyway. Okay, so here we go. The Enterprise reseeded the ozone layer, but it won't hold for long, so they can never use the shield. And then I thought, well, why not just have someone come back every few hundred years and reseed the ozone layer again? I mean, if they wanted to, they could figure out how to reseed their own old ozone layer. And, you know, it's not like it's going to dissolve in a few years. Wouldn't you think it'd take hundreds of years?
Okay. Yes, I agree with you, if I believe for a second that any of this has anything to do with the ozone layer.
Oh, yeah,
layer.
Of course.
So, assuming that that's the case, then your point is valid. But I also don't even get to that stage. I think even before that, you know, what is mentioned is that they are... what is mentioned is that because of the UV light getting in, they are getting ill and they're being poisoned. But specifically, we're talking about light getting in. Light as in the light that was being pushed around the planet through their cloaking device. They specifically state that the cloaking device makes sure that no light gets in, and then they mention later on that light is getting in. Those two things can't coexist. So I call them out on not quite understanding what they're trying to say here.
Right. Plus, they say they can't also use their shield either. So I thought, you know, if that's what caused the situation, which one was it, the shields or the cloak or the combination of both? So if shields are a problem, why is the Enterprise using shields with no problem? So anyway, but either way, even if they could continue to use it, and as the ozone layer degrades again, just keep reseeding it every few hundred years and they'd be fine.
Yeah, but by the way, I mean, I assume everyone knows what ozone is, right? I mean, ozone is just a version of oxygen. If you were sophisticated enough to be able to build a spaceship, you should be able to pretty easily come up with enough quantities of ozone and pipe it into the right part of the atmosphere. It's not really that difficult to do. It's a logistical challenge for people like us. But if you can hover up in space and just pipe out gas, there really isn't much to it. It's not magic. It's just a layer of oxygen that sits up there. A specific type of oxygen, but it is it's just a layer of oxygen.
Okay, you heard that here on the Battle Bridge. Okay, so we end the show with Alexandra coming to the bridge, and she's almost screamed at by Picard, but she just wanted to give him some kind of funky-looking flower and a hug, which causes him to be laughed at, because while she retreats to the turbo lift with Wesley, she leaves her little, I don't know, what is that, a little animal thing? Let me see here.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, her little toy or something. So I guess that's a 24th century equivalent of the kick me sign, huh?
It was something that... did she make that? Where did she get that from? Where did that come from? School, or was it from the
planet? I think it was from our quarters, because I think she had that earlier in the series, earlier in the episode. I want to play that actually back and see. Where we see, I don't know, when we see Alexandra for the first time. But anyway. All right, I guess that pretty much takes us to the end of this one, unless you have anything more.
No, I think we've pretty much, I mean, we've spoken about a lot of things. So I suppose it's now time to give a rating for this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. Now, I've actually watched, this happens more often than I probably should admit. I usually come into the discussions knowing exactly where I'm going to rate the episode, and then we have a chat, and then it's usually a nice chat, and very often you'll influence me either one way or the other, and I start migrating my rating. Okay, so good things about this episode, as far as I can tell. Actually, maybe let me start with the bad things about this episode. The science isn't correct, but then again, you know, whatever. I'm not going to hold that against it. And the episode started with me thinking, oh dear, it's going to be another children episode, children heavy. I actually didn't mind the children, or maybe I didn't mind the children this time. I didn't think there was anything particularly bad with the actors, and you know, I was able to get through it.
I'm sorry, go on.
I was able to get through it. I think from on the good side, actually, we've got a lot of, as I mentioned, I think right at the start, I think we've got a lot of like big ideas in this episode. We've got the ideas of, you know, what does society need to do in order to preserve itself if it doesn't have a natural way of reproducing? And this gets covered again later on in, you know, in other episodes where they go over to cloning and things. We've got big issues about, you know, what would you do for your children if they're under threat? And that's something that is in the background. You've had a society that has forgotten how to use its technology. Actually, to a large extent, fairly similar to Spock's brain, if I can I quote that one with the I think is it the controller in that episode, but you've got a custodian that's taken away, you know, the technology or the needs of the society.
Yeah, the teacher.
You've seen the people.
I think it was. It was the teacher.
The society's kind of fallen back from its peak now that this custodian can give it everything that they need, and that's interesting. It's interesting in two respects. One, you know, you don't have to do the day's labor in order to survive, and you could focus on things like the arts, etc. But then the question that Wesley raises about, you know, surely at every point something goes wrong. How, you know, if you don't know how it works, then how can you repair it? And I think that's a valid question that science fiction should be able to address. You then also throw in the fact that you're attempting to educate these children in talents that they haven't quite discovered yet. And then that harps to things that are then touched upon with like the Masterpiece Society, where, you know, these kids are shown that they're going to be great musicians or artists, and they may not have had the opportunity, had this kind of, you know, focus on the education been there. And you then start getting into questions about, is it better to fulfill your potential versus is it better for you to have free will in your decision making? So this episode, despite everything, has like four or five of these really big ideas clashing together. And it, you know, there is a lot of things here that are, you know, that would get a thumbs up. Personally, I think that the script isn't strong enough to bring everything together. And I think in the end, there's enough ammunition here for it to be kind of like a great Star Trek episode. As it is, I think it comes in just below average, and I would give it a 3 out of 5. So what about you, Lou?
Okay. Well, you know, I've said it before and I'll say it again. I like these stories with the morality, where there's morals at work. And as a father, this really touches home. You know, what's the idea that, my goodness, we live in a world today where your children are at risk just by playing outside, walking home from school. They could be snatched in the time that they're out talking to the ice cream man, getting a piece of ice cream. So, I mean, you know, sometimes you have to be overprotective just to help your children survive. So, the Aldeans take the children, and what if they just decide to cloak themselves or shield themselves and disappear forever? You know, I ask this question, what would the humans on the ship do? Could they just finally leave without their children? And somehow I just don't think so. I think the Federation would have spent more time than the children had to live to try and get them back. Or at least I would hope so. That's what I would do. I'd be in orbit forever until I finally figured out a way to get them back. And then I wondered, even if they have their shields up or even if they're cloaked, are they at all susceptible to a photon torpedo? Could you just lob a few where the planet used to be? It's not like the planet's going anywhere. We know exactly where it's at, whether we see it or not. So again, children are our most vulnerable members of our society. So when a story comes along that preys on their innocence and causes a reaction in humans, that's what I like. It's that reaction which is a lot stronger now, like I said, that I'm a daddy. And that makes me enjoy the story. So all the technology stuff aside, some of it is parts of it is silly. But they took our children. And that has to be rectified. There are, of course, a lot of unanswered questions. And the Peeping Tom aspect of the story seriously creeps the hell out of me. But it's not enough to really take it from the story. So, in the time that we started, you say I influenced you, you kind of influenced me. Because of the morality story, I was going to give this a 4, but I've decided that there's a few things wrong that I have to agree with you. And for that, I ended up at a 3, too.
I was originally coming in at the 2, and you upped me. Actually, because I gave Too Short a Season a 2, and I think Too Short a Season had two ideas that clashed together that didn't particularly work. I think in this episode, we suffer from a similar fate, but I do think that it's better executed, and these stories at least gel a little bit better. And I think, yeah, I think a lot of the points that you made me like reconsider. And I do think that I don't think it's a great episode. I do think that there's a lot of things there that could have made it a great episode. So you pushed me up a notch. Which, if you think about it, had we not had this discussion and I came in at a 2 and you came in at a 4, it would have still been the same as if we both come in at a 3.
Yes, it would have been. That's true. Okay, guys. So that brings us to the end of When the Bow Breaks. And don't forget, when you leave forum comments, also give us your rating for this particular episode.
Lou, where can our listeners leave forum posts?
Oh, at trekmatefamily.com. And when you go to trekmatefamily.com, that will actually go to trekmate.org.uk. But trekmatefamily.com is a lot faster. And at the top of the page there, it says Trekmate Forum. You click that, and you get all the forums. And it's not just us. There's 10 Forward, the Delta Quadrant, a whole bunch of them. And everybody likes to put down their episode and get feedback. So the last one I just posted was Angel 1, and I posted that on, I believe, the 5th. On June 5th, today is June 7th, and we already have 6 comments. So hopefully by the time we get to Angel 1, which is number 14, Angel 1 will be next. So next week when we do the next episode, Home Soil, we'll be doing the feedback for Angel 1. Ain't that nice?
Actually, I don't know if you noticed, but it has been posted the freeze frame of the person taking the glass from the... in Angel 1 has been posted on the forum, so you can see there's a link to a little clip where you can see the person taking the glass from the what was her name, the
Beata.
Elected one,
yeah,
was she
Mistress
the elected
Beata,
one?
Yeah.
As I've mentioned I get confused between a lot of these episodes.
Yeah, that is funny. Yeah, that's true. And we can already give a little bit of a giveaway, but that comes from Renee. And Renee has sent a couple things to us. She was very she was moved by what we were doing for Brian, and she was very sad that Brian passed on. And so her and I have communicated a couple times about that, and hopefully we'll get her on. But she says she's very, very timid and scared, and I say, don't be. Just like Jason. Jason, you know, I want to put this out for you to listen to. Hopefully you've gone this far. Don't be scared. I told you this on email. I'll tell it to everybody. Don't be scared. There's no video involved. I still don't have a clue what James looks like. for all I know, he could be some, you know, three-eyed... Yeah, I don't know. What is it? The long head something the purple people eater. Anyway, the point is you're just basic. We're just talking to each other. It's just one of us happens to be recording this and has to go through all the editing. But that's all it is. It's two people talking to each other, and whoever hears it, well, we don't know who hears it. But don't be afraid, guys. There's no reason to be afraid. If that's what's stopping you from wanting to come on this show to do your review of something on TNG? Well, now you know. You don't have anything to worry about. For all I know, five people are listening around the world, and they're all in the UK, because that's where we get our response from. Anyway, that's the end of that. Let's go ahead and continue on. So,
next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Data's in the hydraulics room alone, and we're hearing laser blasts.
Invisible enemy attacks.
What is it? Could it be alive?
And a small but powerful life force is unleashed.
Evacuating lab.
Now, it's growing.
If this keeps up, it'll tear up the Enterprise.
And declaring war on the crew.
It has the power to destroy this ship and everybody on it.
On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Join us next week as we review episode 18 of season 1, Home Soil. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London. And thank you for listening, and good night, everyone.
Good night. Peeping Toms.
Lou, let me ask you a question.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay. I am currently putting my Star Trek DVDs, or actually my Star Trek Blu-rays, onto a home network.
Okay.
Okay. And I have been doing, at this precise moment, I'm doing the original series, season one. Mm-hmm. What order should you watch the original series, season one in? Do you start at the man trap, or do you start at when no man has gone before? Because I find it very difficult to watch them in the order in which they were broadcast.
Really?
Because
actually, technically, I would start with the original pilot.
With the
That's
cage?
Where I started. Yeah, I started with that. And then there was one, the next one, I would say the first one that was broadcast.
Okay, the reason why I have a problem with that is that people disappear and they change too much because they're not in the right order. So you see like Uhura turning up in gold, and then she comes back. Well, she comes in red, goes to gold, then comes back to red. McCoy disappears because McCoy, he only came in afterwards, right? So he's not in, he starts in the Cormorant maneuver. So he comes in the original run, he came in and then disappears for a couple of weeks and then comes back. And I don't know, there's a part of me that finds it very difficult to choose which order I should have these in.
Let me see something here.
I think I'm going to go production order.
Well, it makes sense. I guess it does make sense. So if we go... So Where No One Has Gone Before shows us production 6149-02. And then 03 is a Corbinite maneuver. 04 is Mud's Women.
Yeah.
But it's also going the same as episode number. So now let's look at broadcast date.
Broadcast date is like the man trap.
You're Mud's right.
Mud's Women. Enemy Within comes quick. And then, you know, one that's really weird is that, I think it's an excellent episode, Balance of Terror, of the original, is, I think, it's the sixth episode made, but broadcast something like 15 weeks later. Very weird.
Yeah. Very weird. Well, I'm looking at it. Balance of Terror was the eighth episode in production.
Yeah.
And it was broadcast on December 13th. You're right, way down there.
Way down the line.
So I would probably say, yeah, I would go by production number, because that's, you know what I would probably say is Memory Alpha has it. They have them in production order, despite the original air date.
You can usually find both of them quoted.
right.
But I think I'm going production.
That makes more sense, because then it flows with the story.
Yeah, I think
you
so.
Know.
I
okay.
Think so. There
well,
we are.
Well, we solved that.